Arctic, which threatens 50% of the world's amphibians with extinction. In fact, we may be in the midst of the planet's sixth mass extinction, and that has implications for us all. Our guest today became fascinated with frogs as a child in Scotland. He went on to become an internationally acclaimed nature photographer and director of the amphibian program at Conservation International. He spearheaded the search for lost frogs that dispatched 33 teams from 21 countries to travel the globe looking for frogs, toads, and salamanders that have not been seen in decades. They were also searching for answers as to why about half of the planet's 7,000 species of amphibians are being threatened with extinction. You can read about this quest in Robin Moore's book, In Search of Lost Frogs. Or stay with us for the hour and hear him talk about it, because he's here this morning. Talk about why frogs matter, about some rays of hope he and his teams discovered as a result of their search, and more. Welcome to the program. Nice to have you here.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
By the way, Robin Moore will be signing copies of his book tonight at 7 at Park Road Books and offering a free lecture Saturday night at 7 at the opening of the 2015 Disappearing Frogs Project Art Exhibition at the Arts Council of York County's Community Performance Center in Rock Hill. Information about both those events can be found on our website at WFAE.org. The foreword to your book is written by a comedy writer, a George Meyer from The Simpsons. Why? How did that come about?
Well, good question. George Meyer has been a longtime frog fan, has actually supported a lot of our work, a lot of the conservation work to protect frogs. His daughter actually has a frog named after her in Sri Lanka.
Really?
Yeah.
What's it called?
It's called, well, Poppy. His daughter's name is Poppy. It's Philautis Poppy. He's a fantastic guy, absolutely genuine guy who just genuinely cares. And when I asked him to write the foreword, he was very gracious. When I told him he had 2 days to do it, he was even more gracious and he did it. Willingly.
Well, he's a writer. He should be able to knock that out.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. But I was thrilled.
He describes you as someone who is going to hurl his entire life at a quixotic mission at which you fully expected to succeed. What were the odds that you and your teams were up against here to do what you wanted to do?
We're sort of facing a massive conservation challenge. You know, we're in the midst of what really is the largest loss of biodiversity on our planet, since the dinosaurs went extinct. It's really at that scale.
Do you think the average person knows that?
I don't think they sort of comprehend that, many people. Yeah, I don't think so. I think it's becoming more, people are becoming more aware, but I still think the magnitude of it isn't really sort of sinking in, and really what it means for people.
So given the magnitude of that, why were you so confident that you and your teams could go out and find these missing frogs and the causes for their disappearance?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think when you work in conservation, you have to remain upbeat. I think, you know, an ounce of hope is worth a ton of despair. You know, I think the worst thing we can do is despair, because feeling powerless, feeling hopeless isn't going to do anything. And I think it's better to light a candle than curse the dark. So I think, you know, it's our responsibility to find those glimmers of hope. Obviously the loss and decline and extinction of amphibians was such a massive and very depressing phenomenon that a lot of species went extinct in the 80s and 90s. And what I realize that, you know, as the century turned, the early 2000s, some frogs that were given up for extinct were actually being found again, you know, after decades.
So there's the glimmer of hope that we'll talk
There was
about.
A glimmer of hope, exactly.
You and I kind of bonded before you even got here, because I love frogs too. I love them. I used to play with them as a kid, and I told you when you walked in the studio that I got a D in one unit in biology in high school because I just couldn't dissect them. I just couldn't kill and dissect a frog. Couldn't do it. They're frogs. Leave them alone. What is it about frogs and salamanders and other amphibians that fascinate you so much? And why go after frogs? Why not go after other species that are going away?
Well, firstly, I think for personally, I just grew up absolutely fascinated by frogs, newts, salamanders. And I think for me, it was, first of all, it was a sort of an entry point for me to nature, because I could go out and I could collect frog spawn. I could raise tadpoles in my bedroom and watch them turn into frogs. And it was almost like watching evolution mm-hmm. in fast forward. I mean, it was like watching, you know, the exodus of life from water to the land, you know. It was just incredible to me that these creatures could do this. And the fact that frogs have been around since before the time of the dinosaurs, I mean, over 200 million years, is fascinating. You know, they've been around rubbing ankles with the dinosaurs. Hmm. So I was always fascinated with fossils. I was always fascinated with dinosaurs. So the fact that we had these living creatures that lived alongside dinosaurs, I think that's something incredible.
I mean, you're a nature photographer, but you're also a conservationist and many other things. But your photographs are spectacular, and we'll talk about them. But you're not afraid to get your hands dirty either, because in your 20s, I'm told that you went into the steamy jungles of West Africa to collect and dissect chameleon poo. Why?
I grew up in Scotland. I did my undergraduate degree in Aberdeen, and I'd never left Europe, but I always had this. I grew up on nature documentaries, David Attenborough, and I just had this real sort of craving to experience the rainforest. I mean, these sort of exotic places, you know, bubbling with life. We didn't have many species in Scotland,
right?
Half a dozen amphibian species. All, you know, with common in front of their name. So, I was craving to go somewhere. And to me, Cameroon, chameleons, West Africa. So I just went there for 2 months. I was 20. And
you dissect their excrement because it tells you what they eat? It tells you how healthy they are? What does it tell you?
It tells you what they eat. So I was looking at basically the ecology of these species, trying to find out what they eat and trying to find out how seven species can live together in the same forest. Huh. You know, are they eating different things? Or how are they reducing competition? So that was sort of my focus.
I said in the opening minute of this program that, and I mixed a metaphor deliberately, that the disappearance of frogs around the world and other amphibians is kind of like the canary in the coal mine. That is true, correct?
Yeah, frogs are the most threatened group, more threatened than birds, more threatened than mammals.
And we understand why?
Well, one of the reasons is that they are very sensitive, that they have permeable skin. So it's kind of like us, you know, wearing our lungs on the outside. You know, they absorb everything. So you put, you know, pesticides into the rivers and they're going to absorb that right through their skin. They have unprotected eggs, you know, they lay in the water. They often have very small ranges. You know, you sometimes have entire species restricted to one stream or one mountaintop. So they're very susceptible to change. So when conditions change, they're very sensitive. The paradox is that they have survived five mass extinctions. Yeah. So they are, in some ways, the ultimate survivors.
If you have these small populations of species that are sometimes, as you say, centered around a particular body of water or a mountaintop, aren't they subject to a lot of inbreeding that makes them even more susceptible to failure because of the genetic consequences of that inbreeding?
If we've sort of forced them into a very small sort of bottleneck, then they can be susceptible to that. Yeah, if they get down to a very small number, and that's one sort of concern when you're taking animals into captivity, breeding them with the sort of hope of reintroducing them. You don't want to do that for too many generations, or right. you're gonna be at risk.
So, getting back to the canary in the coal mine aspect of this, as we see these species disappear or diminish in number or become confined to a tiny little area where they used to have a much broader range, what does that mean for us, for humans?
So, I think it means different things to different people, but if you look at the broader picture, the role amphibians play, they eat the things that we do not like, crop pests, disease vectors. I was just hearing this morning about an outbreak of these little worms in mm-hmm. Charlotte over the last 5-6 years. These are the kind of things that frogs eat. So when you lose frogs, even if you're not really seeing the frogs, you know, they can be cryptic, you're losing the service that they're providing for free. You know, we're having to go in and make up for their loss by intervening in ways that are costing us a lot of money.
But does it also indicate that we're doing something or something is happening, even if we're not doing it, that is certainly hurting them, and mm-hmm. they're on the front lines,
exactly.
So that it's creeping toward us?
Yeah. You know, I think exactly. You know, it's they're sort of the litmus test of the health of the ecosystem, and if they're dying, it's not a good sign for the water that we're drinking, you know, and the food that we're eating. It's just not a good indication.
I hear frogs in my neighborhood sometimes in the summertime, particularly if we've had a lot of rain. But I don't hear them like I heard them when I was a kid. Now, I grew up in a different part of the country, so maybe that's why. Mm-hmm. But are these frogs and amphibians disappearing everywhere or just in particular parts of the world, like in the tropics? Where is it happening?
They are declining across the globe. A study in 2013 showed they are declining at an alarming rate in the U.S. The sort of very rapid and very dramatic declines and extinctions we've seen a lot in the tropics, but they are declining everywhere. And it could be that, you know, in 10, 20, 30 years, we're seeing some that are close to extinction. I mean, already in California, there's one species, the mountain yellow-legged frog, that's gone from being one of the most abundant animals in the region to one of the rarest.
Is that because of the severe drought in California, or is it something else at play?
It's you know, one thing with frogs, it's sort of a lethal cocktail of threats. It's one thing after another. So it's you have drought, you also have introduced fish in their lakes, you have pollutants being, you know, blown upwind, or downwind, rather. You have climate change as a whole. You have this fungal disease that's now spread.
Which we're going to talk about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's you know, the gun is being loaded by all these factors. And
you didn't mention the one I think that you say is the most serious, and that is loss of habitat.
Loss of habitat, yeah. And that's the primary threat to amphibians worldwide is just loss.
What do they need? What kind of habitat do they need that they're losing?
Yeah, it you know, varies according to species. Many are forest dwelling, so we're losing forests at an alarming rate. Many species need both the aquatic and the terrestrial environment. You know, they have aquatic larvae, they have terrestrial adults, which also means we lose a species. It's almost like losing two species. You're losing the role that the tadpoles are playing in the streams and the ponds, and you're losing the role that the adults are playing in the terrestrial environment. So you need that connection. You need fresh, clean water, and you know, habitats around that water intact. And if you break that connection, they're not going to survive.
Robin Moore is with us. He's an award-winning nature photographer, senior fellow at the International League of Conservation Photographers, and the director of the Amphibian Program at Conservation International. He's written a book about his remarkable search for frogs. It's called In Search of Lost Frogs, The Quest to Find the World's Rarest Amphibians. And we'll continue our conversation in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and a sign of the times of the Carolinas, a nonprofit organization presenting the Savoy Ballroom meets the Palladium Ballroom with a mix of swing, salsa, and R&B dancing tomorrow. Tickets available at asignofthetimes.org. And Nexen Pruitt, 190 lawyers helping companies meet challenges, business challenges, in court and at the deal table from Charlotte and seven other Carolina locations. Next challenge, next level, Nexen Pruitt. Sales tax redistribution, economic development, questions of eminent domain, religious freedom proposals, and more, just some of the issues being considered in Raleigh. We were supposed to do this program yesterday, but a technical glitch made us unable to do so. So we'll talk about all of that with reporters who cover the legislature tomorrow at 9. And by the way, you can see a gallery of images of the frog species we're talking about on today's show on our website at wfae.org/charlottetalks.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Congress has reached agreement on oversight of the Iran nuclear deal, a Medicare doc fix, and is working on fast-track trade authority for President Obama, the first 100 days of the Republican-led Congress.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Robin Moore today, an internationally known award-winning nature photographer, about his search for lost frogs. We'll talk about how the search was conducted in a little while, but you mentioned the mountain yellow-legged frog a second ago, and its native land is the Sierra Nevada mountains of California. You went there. You write about it. Talk about that frog. What makes that frog special?
Well, one of the things that makes it special, and you feel this as you're going up to find it, you feel like you're leaving civilization behind. We went a day and a half on horseback into these remote. You'd think they were pristine areas. They look incredible. And that's what makes it all the more alarming, that you crest a hill and you come to these lakes. And what we saw was dead frogs basically littering. These
frogs at one point in time were so prolific that people had to be careful where they stepped, otherwise they would crush them. That's how many there were.
There were tens of thousands, absolutely. They were just hopping all over the place. Yeah, researchers would have to watch their step, exactly.
And so you would actually see dead carcasses of frogs?
We saw dead carcasses, yeah. So there were, lying belly up in the water, and that shows that obviously they'd died pretty recently.
Do we know why?
So there was a wave of sort of die-offs of these frogs a few decades ago because fish were being introduced for fishing purposes. Well,
wasn't it like in the 1850s that they put fish in these pristine lakes that had no fish in them, and that fish and frogs don't like each other?
They don't like each other, yeah.
The fish like the frogs a lot.
Exactly.
Or the frog eggs, I guess, right?
Oh, yeah. And they'll eat tadpoles as well. And because of the cold conditions, the tadpoles will be, often a couple of years in the ponds before they change.
Really? That long? They take that long to turn into frogs?
They can do. When it ices over in the winter, they sort of hide under the ice and then wait till the next year to carry on growing. Yeah.
So that, what does that result in? Ultra big frogs?
Larger frogs. The tadpoles get pretty large. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. They're one of the largest tadpoles in the U.S.
So you wrote in your book that the introduction of, we began tampering with the ecosystem back in the mid 1800s by putting fish in these lakes that had no fish in them, mm-hmm. and then decided a century later that wasn't a good idea anymore. So they started removing the fish from the lakes.
Yeah, and they got some lakes completely fish-free. The mm-hmm. frogs started coming back. And then all of a sudden, this just massive wave of die-offs, just frogs dying off in their droves.
And this massive wave of die-offs is also happening in Central America. It's happening in other places around the globe, and I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that you say, at least in the Sierra Nevada, it's a fungus.
That's correct. Yep. It's a fungus that has now spread to every continent on which amphibians are found.
How does it travel?
Well, that's a good question. There are a lot of different theories about how it travels, and it seems to vary according to where you are. One of the sort of original hypotheses of where it originated was a frog from Africa that was used for pregnancy testing in the 1930s.
Human pregnancy testing?
Exactly. They would put the pee from the woman in the water, and if she was pregnant, the frog would start ovulating. And you didn't need to cut the frog open like you would with a rabbit or a rat to see that. So it was a very easy and convenient pregnancy test.
So they imported frogs for that purpose? Is that
so they shipped them around the world, yeah.
And with them the fungus?
Yeah.
Perhaps.
Well, they've identified on a frog that was preserved in 1938 the presence of the fungus. So they have identified the earliest, you know, one of the earliest known records of the fungus on
this
frog.
Is this fungus the same fungus, is that fungus the same fungus that is killing off the frogs in the Sierra Nevada and throughout Central America and other parts of the world, or is it different fungi going about their business?
It's the same species of fungus. There are different strains of it. Some are more virulent than others, so mm-hmm. some are causing just more dramatic die-offs than others.
But what does it do in the frog population? How does it kill them?
So it basically attacks the keratin on the skin, and it results in cardiac arrest, essentially. It stops the movement of gases
back
through the
forth.
Skin, because frogs rely on their skin. It's permeable skin. They need it to breathe and to interact with the environment. So it just attacks that.
Is there a solution for that? Is this something that man can reverse, that we can, you know, spray something that kills the fungus but not the frogs? Or is that just tampering with the ecosystem in other unintended ways that we don't know what we're doing?
Well, scientists are working very hard on that very question. And so far, the silver bullet has eluded us, but there's some very promising and encouraging research happening now into probiotic therapy, essentially. And that involves manipulating the bacteria that are on the frog's skin that are already there and seem to provide some defenses to the fungus. So they're finding that some frogs survive with the fungus, and it's because of these bacteria on their skin. And some frogs have more of the bacteria than others. So the theory is, it's like when we drink probiotic yogurt, you know, we augment our stomach bacteria.
Right. So
it's tampering, but it's not adding something that's not already there.
Right.
And the theory is that this could be applied to the environment and could give the frogs a helping hand, essentially.
Because of a technical problem yesterday, we reran a show that we had done earlier on the disappearance of honeybees. Mm. Any connection, not in terms of what's causing the disappearance of these two species, but in I'm trying to figure out how to say this, but is there any connection at all in this? Is it the same canary in the coal mine thing? Is it the same thing that we should be paying attention to because it has implications for us?
I think they're all connected. Honeybees, frogs, bats, you know, white nose syndrome in bats is a fungus. I think they're all symptoms of a larger problem. You know, we're tinkering with the environment. We're changing the climate. We're cutting down habitats. We're putting pollutants out there. And I think the loss of these sensitive species and groups are a symptom of that.
If it's said that the honeybee decline is also possibly due to a virus or a fungus or something like that. So if fungi are the culprit here, what is it about what's going on in the world today that's allowing them to proliferate at the expense of other species? Do we know?
I mean, it's not typically in the interest of a disease to kill its host, right? So the fact that these pathogens are actually killing whole entire species is not normal. So we have to look at why that is happening now. And I think part of it is that all these other stressors that we're putting on these animals are compromising their immune systems. So under normal circumstances, frogs would probably not be impacted so heavily by this fungus. It also doesn't help that with globalization, we're moving things around at a rate that's never been seen before, you know.
Things that don't belong in that place are suddenly showing up in whatever place that is.
Exactly. You know, and we know that when you put a disease in a place with naive animals, they're not ready for it. So they're being hit.
And naive means that they have never seen this disease before, so their immune system doesn't know how to, it has no defense against the disease. Well, it's what happened to the natives on this continent when Europeans came here and brought with them smallpox and things like that. They had no defenses.
Exactly.
Climate change. Could it be that the frogs are being impacted by this because they're so sensitive to things, minute changes in their environments, that climate change, a rise of temperature of a degree or two, could cause them distress? Or is it that it allows fungi, to proliferate more quickly and more just further out into the world? Or is it a combination of those two things going on?
It's a combination. Frogs are what we call cold-blooded, so they rely on their environment for to regulate their temperature. They need moisture. So, yeah, absolutely. Changes in climate are going to affect them a lot. And that can compromise their immune systems. And what we're also finding that, yeah, the fungus also has its optimal conditions. And, you know, as climate change progresses, we're seeing the fungus moving higher up mountains. You know, it's being found higher and higher. So it's getting into areas where it wouldn't before have proliferated. Mm-hmm. So it's definitely a combination. And you know, it's not black and white. It's a complex, you know, situation. But different parts of the world, different things are happening. But there's definitely a lot of interactions between those going on.
This is a stupid question, but I want to hear the answer. Because there may be some people out there who are still saying, so what? Mm-hmm. Tell me why frogs and amphibians are important and why the fact that they are diminishing in number is important.
Yeah, it's important because we're going to suffer severe repercussions if we lose amphibians.
In what way?
We're going to see outbreaks of insects, disease-carrying mosquitoes, crop pests. And personally, I think we're impoverishing our world. I mean, for me, amphibians, they colored my childhood. It's mm-hmm. it's that sort of emotional and intellectual enrichment that you get from going out, fishing in a stream, finding tadpoles. If we deprive our children and our children's children of that opportunity, I think we are, you know, we're handing on a world that is greatly impoverished. I don't think that is fair to them. You know, we are making these decisions now that are costing them sort of a more colorful future. Mm. And aside from, you know, the sort of ecological repercussions, which, and many of them we don't even know. You know, it's sort of it's a risky gamble we're taking by eliminating things.
Your childhood, as you've said now several times, was you found this fascination with frogs. You raised tadpoles in your bedroom. You love these animals, these creatures, and who wouldn't? I do. How did that lead to photography? Or did that lead in any way to photography? Is it just coincidental that you ended up being a photographer who takes wonderful pictures of nature and frogs?
Well, My first search for a lost frog, I think, was in 2007 when I went to Ecuador. And we went, hiked up in the Andes, and we found this little green harlequin frog that hadn't been seen in, I think, a dozen years. I never photographed that frog, and I was very caught up in the moment. And I wished ever since that I had, just to have a record of that. And I think it was that moment I decided I'd always been interested in photography, but I decided to really sort of invest in coming back with a record of what I was seeing and the stories that were needed to be told, in my opinion.
So in terms of being a photographer, had you been a photographer up to that point? Had you been a professional photographer up to that point? Or just a casual photographer up to that point?
I up to that point, I'd probably call myself a scientist. I did a PhD and a postdoc. What I found was when I came back and shared images and stories, the response was so much different from when I published a scientific paper.
So pictures are worth a thousand words.
I think they resonate with people in a much different way. I think photography, art, story has a way of evoking something that facts alone cannot.
Hmm. You've been called an outdoor photographer and a nature photographer. How do you think of yourself?
I tend to refer to myself as a conservation photographer because I'm very driven to try and use my images to promote conservation mm-hmm. issues and solutions.
Just because I know that we've done several programs on photography. We have photographers listening to us all the time. You go into these rugged, way out of the way places to do your research and to search for lost frogs, among other things. And when you take camera equipment with you, that has to be difficult. What do you take? What do you use? How do you shoot?
Yeah, it's a challenge. I always try and travel as light as I can, because you don't want to be hiking through the forest with all this gear. I take a camera that's fairly now weather resistant after having a couple of cameras die on me. I realized that having one that can weather the sort of rainforest environment.
That would be what? What do you take?
It's a Canon 5D Mark III is the model I use.
So you don't use an iPhone then?
I don't use an iPhone.
Or a GoPro.
I do use a GoPro.
Do you? Okay.
I always take a GoPro with me. You know, it's amazing that the quality now of some of these, you know.
So you're digital. You don't use film.
Digital is just way more efficient.
Yeah.
I can tell in the field if I got the shot I need.
Right.
Yeah.
But then how do you charge your cameras in the field? I mean, you're in these jungles and mountaintops. There's no electricity. How do you do it?
Well, when we're in the Sierra Nevada, we try to use these solar panel chargers that had worked a little bit. But generally, I try and go in with enough battery power to keep me going for the amount of time that I'm not going to be on the grid. And that's usually the key. Otherwise, sometimes there's just no way to charge equipment.
You take multiple lenses?
Or you
just go in light?
I go in light. I have, when you're shooting frogs, you need first of all, a macro lens. I have a 100mm macro lens that's sort of a lens that stays on my camera most of the time. I then also carry sort of wide angle and ones that give me the opportunity to shoot the animals in their habitat as well.
Does the macro lens give you the ability? I don't know anything about photography. But
okay.
Does it give you the ability to be really close up on a frog when in fact you are not?
You have to get pretty close.
You have to get pretty close. They let you get close.
Some of them do. Some of them. It varies. You have to know the sort of temperament of the species you're photographing to know the best way to sort of wrangle them. And
because you have cover of the dust jacket, you have a close-up of a frog. You have a lot of remarkable close-ups of these frogs. And I thought, well, I wonder, maybe he was 10 feet away and he has a telephoto lens on the camera and they don't even know he's there. But you're saying that you're right up on them.
Right up on them, yeah. The dust jacket of the book is a crop of a larger picture in which one, it's inside the book, a male is calling to the female.
Uh-huh.
So I'm there probably a couple of feet away, and this male is continuing to call to the female. So they're not too bothered by my presence. This is at night, so I'm going in when they're active, they're not really aware, or they just don't perceive me as a threat there. So I try to be as inconspicuous as I can, but you usually do need to get pretty close to get those shots. You know, you don't always want to be shooting with a zoom lens. You want to get a little sort of intimacy. So that involves getting close.
Do you touch these frogs ever, or do you just leave them alone?
I prefer to leave them alone. So that shot, for instance, is, you know, one I came across these frogs calling and shot them. Occasionally, if I find one under a rock or, you know, I want to try and get a better shot. Mm-hmm. So I will sometimes just move them onto a branch or a leaf or
pose them.
Or pose them. Yeah, yeah.
Robin Moore is our guest. He's a photographer and the author of In Search of Lost Frogs. We're coming back. We'll talk more about photography and more about the frog disappearance as well. Stay with us. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Scheele Museum, presenting the Solar System, a journey of exploration, an exhibit featuring hands-on components, objects on loan from NASA and the Smithsonian Institution, and an interactive Mars colony. Details at scheelemuseum.org. And Charlotte Mecklenburg School's job fair for licensed teachers and certified school staff, Saturday, April 25th at the Park Expo, 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Register at careers@cms.com. Congress has reached agreement on oversight of the Iran nuclear deal and a Medicare doc fix, and is working on fast-track trade authority for President Obama. 100 days into the new Republican-led Congress, Diane Rehm and her guests take a look at what's been accomplished and what's to come. That's coming up at 20 minutes to 10 o'clock. If you'd like to join our conversation, email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back.
Dayton, Ohio isn't the middle-class city it used to be.
You know, when you put that down on your resume and stuff, it's like, oh, west side of Dayton, here we go.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Should where you're from dictate how much you make? We'll take you to Dayton next time on Marketplace. We'll have the rest of the day's business news as well. That's all from APN.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Robin Moore is our guest, a conservationist, award-winning nature photographer, director of the amphibian program at Conservation International, and the organizer of 33 teams from 21 countries who went out in search of lost frogs. That's also the name of his book, In Search of Lost Frogs, which he'll be signing tonight at 7 at Park Road Books. And there'll be a free lecture on Saturday at 7 o'clock at York County Community Performance Center in Rock Hill. It's an art project that deals with frogs as well. In one photograph from the book, it was just striking. It looks like an Ansel Adams photograph, but in color, in the Sierra Nevada mountains. And the little caption says that you used a slow shutter speed so that the mosquitoes that were in abundance would not show up in the shot. I'm just curious how you knew to do that, because it seems to me that slowing down the shutter speed would cause these things to be moving in the shot, and that would blur the shot or cause it not to be as spectacular and pristine as it is.
Well, photography is a lot about problem solving under these conditions. You're presented with these challenges, and I knew that a fast shutter speed would freeze the mosquitoes in the shot. Mm-hmm. But the slow shutter speed, essentially, they're moving through it. So you're just completely, you're blurring them out, essentially.
Now, for this shot, you're up in the Sierra Nevada mountains of California, and frogs eat mosquitoes, don't they?
They do.
Because there's another shot in the book of somebody, you're taking the back of them, and they are covered in mosquitoes. It's unbelievable. It's like grains of sand on a beach. Why aren't the mosquitoes being eaten by the frogs? Is that because the frogs are dying and they're not being eaten?
Well, these are the lakes from where the frogs have disappeared. There's a fraction of the number of frogs there used to be. So it's intuitive that the frogs go and the mosquitoes are going to – yeah, they're going to – come out in force.
So this is what we're in for.
Yeah.
In a way. Eliza emails, I grew up in the outskirts of Greensboro, North Carolina, and spent much of my childhood in creeks catching crayfish, turtles, and even the very rare salamander. A few months ago, I was moving rocks around to better cross a creek behind my condo here in South Charlotte and found not one but six salamanders. The youngest were bright yellow with a black stripe. I've never seen so many salamanders in my life. Is that a good sign?
That's a great sign. That's great to hear. I love hearing stories like that because it's often the reverse you hear. But that's fantastic news.
You write about when you were growing up, your interest in frogs fueled an interest in the incredible diversity of life. And you discovered that there had been five mass extinctions and that amphibians had made it through all of them. Do we understand why they were so – they and the cockroaches seem to be survivors. Do we understand why?
I'm not sure we truly understand why. They obviously were well adapted to conditions and conditions imposed by those five mass extinctions. I think we're trying to understand now why, given that they survived that long, they're suddenly at mm-hmm. the forefront of this disappearance. And one of the big differences with this mass extinction and the changes that are happening now is the rate at which these changes are happening.
Yeah, this is alarming. 99 out of every 100 animal species to have roamed the earth are now gone. 99% of them are mm-hmm. gone. This current extinction is much faster than the previous ones, which were very slow moving. The Earth used to lose species at a rate of about 1 million, one in a million, every year. What's happening now?
Yeah, now it's 1,000 times the background rate. It's when I was growing up, you know, you read about extinction as something that happened to the dinosaurs and creatures that were long gone and far away. And then I think, you know, as I started studying at university, I started to realize that they were going under our very nose, you know, that the chances of witnessing an amphibian extinction should be next to nothing, you know, in your lifetime. Hmm. And in the last couple of decades, we've lost, you know, possibly over 200 species.
The loss of the dinosaurs led to the proliferation of mammals and therefore to human beings. Mm-hmm. Is this just part of the natural cycle of things? I mean, are we meant to be here forever? Are amphibians meant to be here forever? Or as they disappear because of climate change and loss of habitat and pollution and everything else that's acting against them, and perhaps us, although we don't know it yet, is that just part of the natural cycle that we'll be replaced by something else?
I mean, extinction is natural. You know, there's no denying that extinction is a natural process.
Can you stave it off? If it's a natural process, can you stop it? Can you reverse it?
Well, the difference with this mass extinction is that it's actually being caused by one singular species.
Us?
Us. So I think we have the responsibility to question, if we're causing this, you know, what is our responsibility to try and mitigate it, to try and steer the future? We have that power. And with that power comes that responsibility.
We have had this long-held belief that we are above the rest of creation, mankind is, rather than believing that we have a responsibility for caring for that creation. Our attitude has been one of dominance and superiority. All you have to do is look back in history and you can see that. And you say that's a gross misconception. But how do you change, how do you change that attitude? And as you travel the world, what are you witnessing? Are you witnessing more of that attitude, or is it beginning to change because we're beginning to wake up and notice that something is awry here?
I think things are changing. And one of the reasons I jumped at the opportunity to come down here to be part of this disappearing disappearing frogs project is because I think initiatives like this that are using art to connect people are so powerful.
You're referring to the Rock Hill Project.
Exactly, the Rock Hill Project. You know, I was talking to Terry this morning, whose brainchild it is, the Disappearing Frog Project that's forming part of this Rock Hill initiative. And she was telling me the response when she put out a call for art. People flooded in. And I think people were desperate to communicate their concern for this.
Well, I don't want to throw cold water on you here, but is that because people who are artists are more sensitive in many ways to a lot of things that are going around them? That's their very nature. That's why they can be artists, because they know things that they can then depict in their art, whether it's visual art or dance or theater or whatever it may be. Whereas the public at large is oblivious to all of this. Is that part of the... In other words, are they indicative of what's really going on out there among the human population?
I think there's always going to be people who are immune to it. There are people who are sensitive to it. I think as we grow into adults, those divisions become more stark. I mean, if you look at kids, what kid doesn't love to go and draw a frog? And I think the more we can try and engage that younger generation, then we're going to see a bigger shift in mindset.
But if you've been able to, if you've noticed, and you have, a difference in your presentations when you just spoke versus now displaying some of the photographs that you've taken of these creatures in the wild while you speak, you've seen a difference in reaction in the audience. Projects like the one in Rock Hill using art to talk about the disappearance of frogs, could that have the same reaction among people who might not otherwise be affected?
Absolutely. I think if you announced that you were having an exhibit that was talking about the disappearance of amphibians, I don't think you would get many people coming, because it sounds kind of depressing, right? But you have an art exhibit that's celebrating the beauty and diversity and wonder of amphibians. You're going to get people there, and they're going to appreciate this art. And through that art, you get the message, but it's not hitting you over the head with that message. I think it's a more when you're approached with or presented with art or with story, I think your mind is more open to accepting ideas than if you're presented with, you know, alarming statistics. I think your mind goes into this sort of mode of, oh, that's one more thing to worry about. I don't want to deal with that. Hmm. So I think it has that potential to unlock that compassion in people.
Right.
You're approaching it in a very different way, and I think that's very powerful.
You're responsible for coming up with this global lost frog expedition. How did you come up with the idea?
Well, it kind of snowballed, really. I think the idea started very small and simple, and I wasn't prepared for how much it would attract attention, actually. The idea was initially to put together a poster of wanted frogs. Ten wanted frogs. I just put this together, this poster. And people just seemed to love it. They thought there was something there, and the team at Conservation International, the communication team, just thought this was had such potential to be a great and positive campaign that we decided to support, you know, over 30 teams to go out there looking for it. You know, we thought, well, it's only going to be interesting if we find some of these things, right?
So you put the poster together and you assemble posses to go out and get these critters. 33 teams from 21 countries. How did you put the teams together? How did they choose you? Did you choose them? How did you choose where they were going to go?
So when I was compiling the list of lost species, I reached out to a network of over 500 scientists for their input. You know, I needed their input. Mm-hmm. What are the lost species? What species should we be looking for? And the response from them was so encouraging. They loved the concept. They loved the idea. So when I put out a call for proposals, I said, who wants to go looking for these? I was suddenly inundated with proposals. Teams were like, we're ready to go, and we want to go, you know, here in the Ivory Coast or, you know, in Colombia and, you know, all over the world. So I was blown away. And to have these people willing and ready and then dispatching into the field, sending me updates, blog posts from, you know, from Borneo. And it was just incredible. Hmm. So it took a lot of life of its own because of the passion and the energy and the drive of each and every one of those. It was over 120 researchers that got involved in that search.
We have a picture of the poster, the Wanted Frogs poster, on our website right now at WFAE.org. And we have some other photographs of frogs that you are responsible for taking. I'm told that most of your teams failed to find the lost species that they were looking for. But what you and your teams discovered gives us some glimmer of hope. Talk about that.
Yeah, overall it was, you know, a sobering confirmation that many of these species have probably gone. The few species that did turn up were, you know, many were a surprise, you know. So they're clues, you know, why have these species survived where others around them went extinct? And I think to understand how we protect these and other species, we need to understand that. What sets them apart? You know, is it something genetic? Is it these bacteria in the skin? Mm-hmm. And we can take those lessons and apply them. So, you know, it's reassuring to know that some species are more resilient than we thought. I mean, a good example is a frog in Israel that disappeared in the 1950s when its wetland habitat was drained. In the 90s, after 40 years with no wetland habitat, it was declared extinct. The first amphibian to be declared extinct. It featured in children's textbooks at school as this, you know, poignant symbol of extinction. We've mm-hmm. lost a species. You know, it's a small country. It was one of our top 10. It's on the poster in 2010. And when we put that poster out, a ranger in a park in Israel turned to the country's leading scientist, said, I'm going to find that frog. And, you know, the scientist was like, well, good luck. You know, I've been searching for 30 years. He said, well, give me a year. A year minus a week to that day, the ranger calls the scientist and says, you're not going to believe what I just found.
Wow.
The scientist, you know, drops what he's doing, drives out to the reserve, looks at this frog and realizes it's the first hula-painted frog to be seen in 55 years. It made national news. I went to Israel. My taxi driver from the airport knew the story about the frog. I didn't even have to tell him. He started telling me the story about the frog.
Wow, yeah.
So to see that sort of local pride, something going from a symbol of extinction to an icon of hope, and it's because the wetland was reflooded. So it just shows that if you give nature a chance, then it can surprise us.
We have less than a minute left. Since they face this plethora of challenges, climate change, loss of habitat, fungus, etc., what can be done? What can we do? What should we be doing?
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to be sort of educated, responsible citizens, spreading the message. We need to be vigilant about what we're putting into the environment, you know, using pesticides or herbicides. In our gardens, if we're gardening, are we using native species? You know, we should be encouraging native rather than exotic species. And, you know, get involved in your local groups. There's many groups out there doing monitoring. Become sort of active in the community, I think.
You also talk, we have time to talk about this, but you talk about gunpoint conservation, because a lot of the places that you go to are controlled by rebellious, drug-running, violent groups.
Mm.
They're actually helping, you say. Is that right?
Well,
involuntarily.
Involuntarily. I mean, yeah. It's sort of, it's a double-edged sword, really.
They're keeping developers away.
They're keeping developers away.
With that, we have to stop, and I wish we could talk about that because that's really interesting. Robin Moore, author of In Search of Lost Frogs, The Quest to Find the World's Rarest Amphibians. Thank you for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. Our producers are Aaron Kiever and Tim Ross. Our associate producer is Alexia Girodi, and the engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information,